beginning of the study session after supper with Debbie on Faulkner's The Bear with Rick this Saturday after supper, the 3rd of February, 73. Channel 1 over, beginning the study session with Debbie and Rick on The Bear this Saturday after supper, the 3rd of February, 73. Channel 1 right, beginning the study session with Debbie on The Bear with Rick and Faye this Saturday after supper, the 3rd of February, 73.
it's the first part of it, up to the part, the hunt. The hunt that is the part, that's enough for him to repudiate the place, isn't it? And he's already going far enough just in the hunt to do that.
Well, I think he's gone far enough in the hunting to give up sort of give up the civilized world, if you will, go into the wilderness. He General Compson says that Ike is the best woodsman of all of them, even when he's just a boy, even when he's just 15 or 16, he's the best. And but I think he's got to be old enough. He's got to go on and be 21 and have looked back at his family and looked back at what's happened to his family, as much as what's happened to him in the wilderness. This is why I don't think he could repudiate just on the hunt.
Well, where is he? How old is he when he's talking to the cats?
He's 21.
Well, what happened to him when he was 16?
That's when the bear is killed.
Well, what happened to him in the commissary? Doesn't he, isn't there, I forget that, isn't there a first view of those ledgers back in 16?
Oh, that's right. When he realizes what's happened with Eunice and Thomasina. He reads in the journals that his grandfather has had an illegitimate child by Eunice and then another illegitimate child by that daughter.
Now that's when he's 16.
No.
He realizes and he sees something of it, and then when he goes back when he's 21, he knows what he'll find.
But he's read it before. He read it. Here it is. But there's how old he is then, the first time. Oh, he's 16, yes. He is 16, yeah. I haven't been doing that too.
Well, what's happening in those 5 years? I don't know.
He looks at it, I suppose. And that's when he decides when he's... until he's 21 and he's to inherit it all that he gives it out.
What they say is now that he sees enough in his own culture that he can repudiate it.
He sees all the injustice. It's mostly looking direct. Well, it's mostly looking directly at his grandfather and what Carruthers has, McCaslin has done that causes him to be so revolted by it, I think, where I read it, more so than Buck and Buddy. They don't.
Oh, when he's 21, that's when he is supposed to inherit.
Mm-hmm. He's to inherit the land, and he gets his heritage from Uncle Hubert. When he's a boy, Uncle Hubert has given him a silver cup filled with gold pieces, and he puts it in a burlap sack and he seals it shut with sealing wax. And they say that they make these trips to go and hand the legacy from his uncle around, and they all hold it. And then after a while, he only gives it to the boy to hold. And what he's doing is he gradually takes the money out and he puts in little IOUs until when the boy's 21 and opens it up. Not only the silver cup is gone, not only that, he's replaced it with a coffee pot, but all the money's gone, and it's been replaced, except for some copper money, and it's been replaced with paper, with little tiny wads of paper, so that it's just, this is his legacy, it's sort of, in one page, it turns from gold to paper. He shows it happening. The list with the...
I don't know exactly how that fits into the idea of book four. He is repudiating his...
Well, he gives up the land and his name, his family heritage. And as I read it, having this monetary legacy be no good too is sort of added on top of, it's like almost like his punishment for having given up. He doesn't get any money either. So that having taken these vows that he takes, he's almost like a monk in giving things up. He lives like a monk. He marries, but he lives in one room, and in the beginning of the book, in the first story, they talk about Uncle Ike as an old man living in one room and living with the same coffee pot and having nothing. He's given it all up. So that not having his financial legacy, too, is part of it. He couldn't have it. Probably if he'd had it, he'd have given it away then.
Well, I'd like to sort of keep it within the realm of possibility. I wouldn't exactly say he lived like a monk.
Well, no, that's strong. But he takes vows. You talk about taking vows. He takes the vow of poverty and the vow of that's too strong to say he's a monk, because what he's doing is stepping outside of society rather than, I suppose monks are. Monks are outside of society too, but in the Middle Ages they were the society. So in the monasteries were. You get confused calling them a monk.
Yeah.
It's just the idea of the vows that he takes, and that he renounces the world. He renounces the world that he knows. He renounces his heritage. He renounces wealth. And it's religious. He talks about God when he's talking about the South and the war. It's all part of God's plan, as he describes it to McCaslin. So that he comes across to me, anyway, as a very religious man. Or at least, he's a very highly moral man, anyway. Whether religious is the right adjective.
Well, that's another thing. That plan that he talks about, the plan, that could be more political than religious. You see, you've got the plan that went down, you see, and then you had the new world and another plan.
Yeah. But he always talks about God doing it. Some he who's doing it. No, his education was in the woods. What's his thesis? What's that? Beautiful thing about the woods are his alma mater, and he goes from grammar school to high school to college, all in the woods.
Did that
ever end?
Uh-huh. I didn't
read that. You should have marked it up.
Yeah. If Sam Fathers had been his mentor in the backyard rabbits and squirrels his kindergarten, then the wilderness the old bear ran was his college, and the old male bear itself, so long unwifed and childless as to have become its own ungendered progenitor, was his alma mater. Well, it's just saying, he's just saying that the boy has learns more in the woods than he does anywhere else. But outside of...
Well, is he following Emerson's education as a scholar at... you can tell how much a man has lived by talking to him 5 minutes. And the scholar has to live. Now, living, I have to shift that over in the other terms. Active life, you see, and action don't mean anything to me. That's an old term that has no meaning. But experience, doing things, having experience, that's what we call it. So he has learned from experience, in Emerson's term, as a scholar.
Yes, in the woods. Yes, he has, like you say.
Well, that's putting experience way over. Emerson puts experience last. He says his scholar needs a moment.
He learns, as I see it, he learns the majority of the reason that he gives up from the ledgers. He learns... pride and humility, yes, in the woods, but the reason that he then gives up his culture is because of what he sees about his family, what he learns about his family, and then having the combination of the two, of what he's learned about truth, if you will, if you want to use that word, in the woods, or humility and pride. And as what could be and what is in his family, so.
I don't think the family's got that much to do with it. It could be that he combines Emerson's nature, and nature, you see, nature in itself is a term that's very hard to use. Charles Anderson. Talks about it in Emma Dickinson, the book on Emma Dickinson, calls it The World Outside. Now, it's in the world outside that he has experience in nature, mm-hmm. or the world outside.
Yeah.
As far as you see it.
Mm-hmm.
hunt. It's not just maturity, it's through a hunt. In the terms that some of the articles say, it's just the old variation of the old Emersonian view of what education of the scholar. You can take it in terms you want to, but what I'm thinking about is taking it in terms that would be useful to.
Well, that's how when I was typing a little bit about it this morning, that's how, about part four, that's how I saw it. I saw it in terms of what we're doing here, about knowing and seeing things. Ike knows, and because he knows, he can't, you can't live, you can't know something and live with it, knowing that it's wrong, or knowing that you would not adhere to it and have any kind of peace. And this is what he tells McCaslin, that's what he wants. He wants to have peace. And so knowing what he does, both that the things that he's learned in the woods and the things that he's learned outside the woods, in the town, if you will, he's got to give it up.
Yeah, and then he tries to live it. And that launches him out on those trips to deliver this $1,000.
Fonseca.
We see one of them.
The girl, Fonseca.
Fonseca. In Arkansas. Now that was
That's a pretty dismal picture. She marries a black man from the north who is sort of a preacher. And the picture of him is reading with spectacles and no lenses in them. And he just reads by the fire, and they're living in utter poverty. He gets a pension. But he banks it with the commissary in the town who does not take care of it properly. So Ike takes this money to Fonseca, that his grandfather has given to her because this whole family is his grandfather. They're his cousins, really.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess they would be cousins, same grandfather, has willed them $1,000 so that he won't have to, after his death, so that they'll be taken care of. But while he's living, he doesn't have to call them his children. That revolts Ike, too.
And he doesn't have to pay the $1,000.
Yeah, right. Everybody else has to. Carruthers is cool. It's a pretty raw old thing, I tell you. Even his sons, Buck and Buddy, sort of repudiate him because they move out of the house after he dies. They move into the slave quarters and they move the slaves into the house, into the big house. They lock them into the big house with one door at night, and they all go out the back door, and they have this agreement that just as long as they're back in the house, by the next morning it doesn't matter where they go, they can just walk out the back door, but they always lock them in the front door.
I don't know, you say, you wonder, he, and Faulkner says, you see, that it comes on down from Jefferson and his compatriots into the north he gives up, and now it's the south, the only hope, and it's two twin brothers who, where the hope is. Now, what's he doing with that? Just playing with the idea of prophecy, or being denominated by the Lord, just playing with that idea, or just borrowing it, just using it as something. He doesn't mean it, certainly, that Uncle Buck and Uncle Buddy are going to have been
perhaps he's trying to explain it. Maybe he thinks that if he puts it in those terms, that McCaslin will understand. Maybe he's trying to have McCaslin understand because he feels that McCaslin is his father in some sense.
I think in that time they used that, so that was the common thought. It would be political, you might say, economic or something, but they would express it in those biblical terms, you might say, or the Hebrew terms.
Old Testament, sort of. The Old Testament God. Fire and brimstone.
Well, now, you see, it sort of begs the question you've got that to start with. But if you don't have that idea as a scholar, you see, you'll be going out on all sorts of sort of fruitless limbs.
Mm-hmm. Well, I didn't, I used his word, repudiation, renunciation, rather than, which is really more, really simpler just to say that he's in a position of doubt. I think Faulkner wants it to be stronger than just doubt. Because you can doubt something and still be in it. You still be a part of it, even while you doubt it. But if you give something up, that's a little bit stronger. That doesn't leave you any quarter to remain part of something.
Well, he puts him out by himself so that no one can feel akin to his experience, too, if you can believe in those things. And I think it would suffer. I think the Ike would suffer. So that he'd just be taken as fiction. It's a story.
So he has to stay in.
And the way this is made it so strong that no one would read it and feel any identity with it. And nobody's going to repudiate their own household and not take it if it's will to them, you see. No one's going to carry it that far. That's a rather fruitless way of going, you see. He can take the property and use it and still vote Republican. So the whole construction that Faulkner has is unworkable. Understand reason. I don't think it does. I think you put it in such terms that you can't handle it. I'm not sure just how much what that clears up. You see, if you put it into the Simpsonian terms. It would seem to say that Faulkner too thought in those Emersonian terms. I think he did. I think he belongs in the Emersonian world. And the same thing is true for him as is true in that first statement in Self-Reliance that you haven't gone into. I think that's the world that he lives in, but you haven't given it a name, right? That first five paragraphs of several lines. And you can't get an Emerson without it. As I get into it, at any rate. I don't think fiction is easy to handle. It's had as many pitfalls as anything else. Just plain traps.
Mm-hmm.
And it has a great deceptiveness that you read it and think you're getting something. See, I never read much fiction, and you've read a great deal, but it wouldn't apply to me as much as it would to you. But it would, you know, and as far as I went, I just didn't go as far as you did.
You've always got stories to think
of. But now, you see, fiction also does this. It brings things to life, enables you to see a little bit. And but there's still that intellectual side. It's very difficult just to follow the talk between Cass and Ike and book form.
It's Faulkner is a genius at making you think that you've gotten the sentence under your hat until you're at the end of it, and then you don't.
Yes. Well, he so much of it he talks about it on what the bearing is. He puts the south above the north, you see.
Mm-hmm. And there's all that business of.
But that's not necessarily a love of the south so much as it is suspicion of the sort of world. I don't know. I haven't looked at that recently enough, and I never did pay too much attention to it. I don't think it's worth fooling with. I think Faulkner's probably using. I'm not sure, but I think he's using sort of pre-1914 terminology. I've read a great deal of it, first and last. They talk in those terms. You see, it invaded, carried over in a general talk.
Mm-hmm.
Now you've got the relationship with his wife.
She's after the land.
Well, the wife then is interpreted as the acquisitive one, and the one that binds you to the social. That's the way it's put in.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that I completely got that all straight. Anyway, that just the business when they're talking, the house, I never got straight where the house came from. Then when he comes back and somebody's already told her about the house and then she gets going on the land, and I didn't get that straight, that conversation between them.
Now what you want to do is use it and you see what I do in that. I take Emerson into it in order to explain Faulkner, and then that enables me to see Faulkner. I'm not sure just how far you can go. So it's not Faulkner I'm using, but it's Emerson I'm using to understand Faulkner. Let's see where he's going. But now, if he thinks in those terms, as a follower of Faulkner, you're beholden to say those terms too. But you don't. You never repudiate anything.
Me?
Yeah. And you're more than 20, 16.
I don't know. I'd say I've taken a few vows. Just look at the record.
Great many considering.
Considering that I didn't have any family ledgers to learn about.
You can learn more from Ratliff than you can from Ike.
Well, more for out here, possibly.
Well, out here, you won't be out of here long. That's not going to help you out of here.
Well, wait, let me finish. I think you can pick up. I picked up, just simply looking at the hunting. That you and Rick have been working on the hunting so long. Just looking at the hunt, I picked up a lot of things. That Rick came in the other day and said that the statement about it being so brutal. Faulkner looks at it just the way Mr. Weaver does. When the dogs get killed.
Yes. The man's world.
And the dogs and the animals in the woods are just people. They're all equal. The man and the dogs and the animals, they're all equals in the wilderness. Mr. Weaver doesn't think in those terms, but you see the dogs, for example, as people in this. The portrait of the dog that kills the bear, the lion, is stronger than the portrait of most of the men in the hunt. Stronger than Despain or General Thompson. You see more of the dog. How the dog's mind works.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Weaver's not very good at building up dogs or people. And I don't know that any countryside is good at that. It can go so far. Barbara used to build up a horse. She could do a person or a horse. Barbara Long. Mm-hmm. I ought to get out some of those tapes where she talks about the horses and some of the people there at the tilts.
That's right. That would help.
That would help
both of us.
Help anybody.
Help all of us.
Yeah, she's 20 years old. How do you stand? How do you figure with your experience? You see, you've made certain choices and you've done things deliberately. Now, you're certainly not a Spartan with your.
With what?
Even you wear across your hands.
No. of the month. Oh. Well, you could use that in feeding the body instead of the mind lately. I think that... I don't know, you say doing things deliberately. And the only deliberate thing I've done is to... try to adapt to as many different things as I can.
Yeah.
And I've done fairly well at it.
Yeah. Well, that certainly doesn't sound like I.
No.
Oh, it doesn't sound like Ratliff. It sounds the reverse of Ratliff. You just made it impossible to be like Ratliff.
Now, wait a minute. Ratliff goes all over and talks to everybody. The people are fairly homogeneous, but he's adapting a little bit so that he can listen to all of them.
Oh, that's what you mean. That
I didn't say so.
Well, he goes all over. He knows everybody in a radius of 50 miles. They're not all going to be just the same. They're going to be the Armsteads and the Bookwrights, too. They're different. You talk to all of them.
But you don't talk to the Varners. Or the Bookwrights. I don't know. I'm not needling you. I just hold it open.
Uh-huh.
We don't have to keep it open. And furthermore, you get hipped on these no-count plays.
Sensitive or dramatic.
But you know what that did? That helped me look at the hunt. Mr. Weaver's account of it. There's no drama in it at all. And whatever. He has the points. See, the man says if he's not enough, they don't raise fast enough. Well, there you go anyway. What to do? Says he didn't like to kill him, then he can't hunt him. And then the man says, there's just one. And he didn't, Mr. Weaver doesn't finish that until he gives all the circumstances. Then he speaks it again, that there's one that I never could catch. So it's certainly... And then he loses that in a great deal of talk about the way the man hunted. Say, I'll leave that out and put it in. You put it that same place. Well, that'll kill it. You gotta move that a little bit. Just gotta move it. That part of it. And so there's no sense of dramatic in him, and I don't think there is in Tuck Mack.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember the dramatic. I can't remember that. Many of them.
More with Cookie than anybody.
Oh, he just withholds it. Fine.
Kind of developed it, I think. Just like from having
the
audience.
Mm-hmm.
Uniform.
Yeah.
Maybe I was carrying over from that, the idea that they all perform, and just connecting that in my mind with the dramatic and not using it in the right sense of the word, using it too superficially.
Oh, you use it in the usual sense. Everybody uses it, you can keep on using it. But what I'm saying is it doesn't carry over into Mr. Weaver. Eliminate the word manic, except Mr. Weaver.
The experience is enough. It was Mr. Weaver, yeah.
I just opened it up for you to see. But now you see, you read it, but I worked it out for you. Now what you ought to do is read something, read the articles on it, work it out yourself. Now you ought to face Mr. Weaver's world directly. I mean, you see, that's the only way I get ideas on it. I read those damn fool articles. I didn't know anything. All summer, but read them and kill me. And you got no choice. If you read a book, you got to read something on it now. You can't trust your own little senses because they're not developed enough. You see, these people that write books now are learned. They're not just little learned. They are just learned big. You got back in my time when I was coming up, you had old Tate and Ransom, people like that. Ransom wrote those little poems called Hebrew Melodies, and he learned Hebrew to read the Old Testament.
Just to write those.
Yeah. Look at that chart. Charlie says now you see your translators are not scholars any longer, they're poets. The poets are better scholars than the old scholars, is what he really didn't quite say. Now you've got Dickie on here talking. He's going to be the poet residence here next term. And you've got him over in South Carolina, and he was on the Today program to celebrate the 10th anniversary of the death of Robert Frost. And what he did was bring up the book on the life of Frost. And he showed Frost to have lived a mad, demonic life like O'Neill. So that's his scholar. He's a poet.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and this ordinary farmer like Frost was just a mask. Publicity put on deliberately, is what he said. Taking it from the book on him, he didn't make it up, you see. Well, now that's the sort of world, that's what your poets are now. God Almighty. That's the reason I don't read poetry. I can't. Fairly learned to protect yourself if you don't do anything at all. You know, Plato has that little rhapsode Ion. Makes all, he can make verses and sing. Makes all manner of fun out of him. He don't know what he's singing. Well, you gotta draw a line somewhere. And Ward are not interested in the things we do out here, and none of them are. It's a world they don't know and don't want to know. They want to. They're perfectly willing to. You see, talk about Faulkner. If they talk about Faulkner, they'll do it in all those cognitive terms, so you don't know what to talk about. That's the way they do. That's academic. Well, that's the common way of doing it. But you see, everybody may come to that. You see, I don't know, But I think it's forcing people. The thing I found is, you see, that not many of them make that grade. They never get very far. They don't become scholars in any sense of the word. They go through school and half-baked, and they got all these curious notions about books lodged in their mind, and then they never get out of because they don't keep reading books. I've got rid of a lot of those odd notions that lodged in my mind by the simple process that I kept on reading the books. And eventually I saw how burdensome most of those things were, you see. Talk about the humor of Chaucer. Well, it's got no meaning. You don't read Mark Twain's humor, you see. Leacock discards the term. He just calls it the way he looks at things. And what he's trying to do, Leacock says, is tell you what he sees. He's trying to tell you the truth, is what Leacock says. So, you see these abstractions get you. Well, I think that's gone a long ways, you see, when you begin to distrust the abstractions, but you still have to use them. You still have to make statements. But you don't have to use those damned old abstractions like art. They'll get you every time, you see. They're cliches. They don't express meaning, they hide it. They stand in between. You talk about Mr. Weaver, he's not dramatic. What is he? Well, he lets the dogs do something. They move. He has a little race. You have one little glimpse of it. Well, that's fairly informative, you see. What I say there is fairly informative. I'm not using any terms that assume a great deal. I would do that. I would do that, I believe. I'd tackle that world in an abstract way and say what it consists of, make statements about it, and then work it out. You see, how far has Mr. Weaver gone towards the Amazonian qualities? You don't have to use those. You can use any you want. I use them. I'm sort of used to them. I find them rather fruitful. But I don't stick with them. I use any that anybody wants to use. We're not looking so much at Mr. Weaver anymore. We're looking at the kind of world he lived in. We're looking at the evil and on the hunt. We're looking at what the hunt, what went into the hunt, and he went on. And all like that. So.
Past depression.
So, and I think it's now you see, Ward talks about the cottage. I say this abstract. You see, he fumbles around with words. There's no such word as cognitive. He only didn't make up any such word as that. This is what we've said before. It's not the experience that's interesting, it's the meaning of it, it's the direction of it. But you see, you want to give the experience, but just let the direction come out of it. You don't want to abstract the meaning from the experience. You see, that's all he does. He abstracts it. He never gives you the experience. Well, now look at this hunt in here. This one I've been working on, you see. This thing with Ed Rush. You got that little bear thing, that little challenge, and then he goes out there with three times and catches it. Then we go back and he fills it out, and then you see the dogs. He's talking about Mr. Ed Rush's dog Buck. Then all at once, right there, in that one, while the words in his mouth, it's not old Buck that he's singing about. It's that young dog he's got, the one that lost his foot with the screw on. And that brings him into, you see, a whole new glimpse. He doesn't even remember the name of the dog. And it just come to him, just like that, you see. You can see his mind working. Well, don't you That's what I like. That's what I like. And the meaning of it doesn't stand in the way of looking at the experience. You get the experience and you get a little meaning with it. And all the experience you see comes, builds up. And you see, this is a hunt's not just this bear thing. A man goes out and runs his dog three times. But it's got all these other things in it. That's the direction of it. You got Mr. Keith, you got all these people from the countryside. And then on top of that, you got to add the one that when he got home and told him about that cat, they said, well, if we'd known you were going to catch that cat, we'd have gone. And he said, that's the way it always was, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You see? So there's a great deal of talk goes into these hunts. Well, look at this hunt he told me. He told me in December of 71 about the talk he had with a man from Gainesville, McClinney, that spring, and it's about a hunt that took 15 years before. And he jumps around.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how much talk there is. There's been ever since. And Ed Rush called him up and said, this fellow had been over there and the other fellow had been over there, and I don't get it. Look how much talk there is in that hunt.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that's the world. I was down here in time to see that world, and that's the world that I spurned. I'm going to put that in. I like the word. That I spurned. I wasn't even condescending to it. I just spurned it. I wouldn't even look at it.
I did.
The damned old world. I got on here in time. I got Florida. Felt enough to see it. I got here before the 441. Paved River Sticks Road, Junction Road, and paved it till after I away after I came out of here. I don't want to write fiction like Faulkner's. I don't want to read it much. I'll read it because I have to. I want to read things I understand. I don't want to be nettled. I don't use the word confused, it's got no meaning. I don't want to be baffled. I'm not confused, I'm just baffled. I don't know what to make of it. I'm trying to make some of it, but I don't know what to make of it. So, you see, I don't know how far up the scale of art I can go. I don't think I can go that far. You see, I worked with Ms. Rawlins Cross Creek, And it was, oh, I hate to think how long it was before I realized that she doesn't have any middle class people in it. No one to sue. No one who can sue her. It's just like we used to talk about the niggers or some poor fella. Or you can talk about the man over, like the mountain guide over there in Greece, because he'll never read it and his folks won't sue you. But you see, the one, Velma?
Yeah.
Yes. She's the one middle class person she talked about. And she it was very strong language, but she was, her whole heart was in it, and she liked Selma. And Selma was the head of her community. She kept things going. Ms. Glisson told me about Selma. She said she was in everything that come to that community. She took a hand in it. And if anybody wanted anything, they found out anything, they'd go to Selma. Selma Kaysen. Her name was. Well, all she writes about is Willis Slater. That's this fella's mother. He lives over here. He married one of Marvin's sisters. He lived over here. He's the one that was out there in the brush. You see, living on the ground. Well, she couldn't write about him now because he got a job. Yeah. But you see, I don't catch on quick. And I don't want to read it unless I can make contact with it. I quit that long ago. This career book is how old. And if you can see that, you see, if you make contact with people and see that much about them, as Mr. Weaver did that time. None of your classmates can. None of your friends can. And report on it, you see. It looks to me like that's where the premium is. And after you learn to do that, then it depends on how you're going to use it.
I just want to read one part from my very favorite story. Can I just read one sentence? When he and Uncle Buck ran back to the house from discovering that Tommy's turtle had run again, they heard Uncle Buddy cursing and bellowing in the kitchen. Then the fox and the dogs came out of the kitchen and crossed the hall into the dog's room, and they heard them run through the dog's room into his and Uncle Buck's room, and then they saw them cross the hall into Uncle Buddy's room, and heard them run through Uncle Buddy's room into the kitchen again, and this time it sounded like the whole kitchen chimney had come down, and Uncle Buddy bellowing like a steamboat blowing, and this time the fox and the dogs and five or six sticks of firewood all came out of the kitchen together with Uncle Buddy in the middle of them hitting at everything in sight with another stick. It was a good race.
You mean that right in the house?
That's right in the house. I had the fox in the house. I kept him under the bed. Now, I thought I'd go back. The same thing happens at the end of the story when they come home. When they got home, just after daylight, this time Uncle Buddy never even had time to get breakfast started, and the fox never even got out of the crate because the dogs were right there in the room. Old Moses went right into the crate with the fox, so that both of them went right on through the back end of it. That is, the fox went through, because when Uncle Buddy opened the door to come in, Old Moses was still wearing most of the crate around his neck until Uncle Buddy kicked it off of him. Southie just made one run across the front gallery and around the house, and they could hear the fox's claws when he went scrabbling up the lean pole onto the roof. A fine race while it lasted, but the tree was too quick. "What in damn hell do you mean?" Uncle Buddy said, casting that damn thing with all the dogs right there in the room. "Damn the fox," said Uncle Buck. "Go on and start breakfast. It seems to me I've been away from home a whole damn month."
You know, I didn't even see that when I read that little piece.
That's what... That and when Tommy's turtle runs out of the cabin are my favorite.
Well, when did you notice that part of it?
First
all
time
along?
I read it. First time I read it. The dogs
now
and
Carter,
the fox.
Now, Work Carter told me pretty much the same thing. I visited him, and he said he went over a fella's house, a friend of his, and he sat down, and he thought the fella had a dog. And he looked down and said, "I'll be damned, that thing moves awful fast for a dog." It was a fox. And the fella had gotten a fox and made a pet of it. And Work told him, "You know that fox is going to chew up your lamp cord wires." And he looked down and chewed the one up over there. And he said, "Now, I just plug it in. When he gets a hold of the other one, it's shocking." And he went over to do it. And it'd be damned, but the fox had already chewed that one up too. Well, the wife wouldn't put up with it. So she made him put the fox out in the kennels with the dogs. And said they got along. They'd eat together. Of course, they'd grit their teeth a little bit and look at each other when they ate. And Wart would just kind of raise his lip a little bit and you could see his teeth. But as soon as you open that kennel, that fox took off and the dog's right behind him.